Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with the April 1st fiscal year approaching in New York State, that means the deadline is fast approaching for the annual budget legislation and the many, many things that might go in it or with it, from property tax rates to school funding to Medicaid cuts to rent laws to bail reform to legal cannabis, maybe, to congestion pricing to fund the MTA. And beyond. Governor Cuomo joins us now with his take on where it should all wind up. Governor, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Makes me tired just listening to your list.
It's hard to prepare these segments. There are so many issues in play at the same time. Let me start with marijuana to make a segue from our previous segment, which was on the progress of the New Jersey recreational legal marijuana law, which seems like it might actually be passed next Monday in Trenton. I see you announced yesterday that marijuana legalization will not make it into the budget. What's holding it up?
The marijuana I support. I made the proposal in my state of the state, and I believe we'll get it done this year. The budget is a moment in time in the process where I try to get as many decisions made as possible, because the legislative process can go on ad infinitum, and some of these issues we've been talking about for years. So the budget presents an opportunity to say, okay, we've been talking, let's decide. The legislature early on marijuana, and for us, marijuana is a relatively new issue. It really started with my proposal this year, but they have signaled that they need more time to talk about it. Therefore, I didn't want to count the revenue from marijuana in this budget. If we could get it done by the budget, that would be great. But there's a whole legislative session after the budget, and my take is it will be done during the legislative session post budget, and therefore I took the revenue out of the budget.
The Nassau and Suffolk county executives, both Democrats, announced recently that they would opt out their counties altogether if a bill does pass. Do you have an opinion about that, good or bad or neutral, and does it matter to the fate of the statewide bill if Long Island is completely out?
Well, it's a good question. It doesn't help the passage if localities are announcing that they're opting out, because then it puts the local legislator in a state legislator in a position that they would be passing a law that their district said they want to opt out of. I don't think it's determinative. It does make a difference on the statewide revenues, and it will cost those municipalities, localities that opt out, because then they would not get the local share of the revenues. But it's not helpful politically to the passage, Brian, right? If you have local governments or counties saying we want to opt out, obviously.
When we talk about the state budget, there are many things that determine what the state budget can be, no matter what it's spent on, local tax revenues, what the federal government does. I know you've been talking about President Trump in recent days about a number of things, and one of the things that is that he's proposing big federal cuts to Medicaid that you're afraid might trickle down to the state level. So why don't you talk about that and what else is on your mind with respect to Washington?
Look, I've been in the federal government. I've been in the state government. I've been in the private sector. I have never seen a federal government as hostile to New York as this federal government. Put aside the international policy, where we have a president who just continually reaffirms his spirit of division. We saw it with New Zealand again, his reaction to New Zealand and the horrific killing. On a domestic level, he has gone out of his way to be negative and retaliatory to Democratic states. We saw that first with his tax reform bill that not only helped the rich at everybody else's expense, it then targeted the Democratic states with the so-called SALT provision ending the deductibility of state and local taxes, costs our state $15 billion more, and our state is the number one donor state to the federal government to begin with, since Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's time, God bless his soul. So the SALT he hurt us with, he then refuses to fund the Hudson River tunnels, which they admit are very important, 450 train trips per day, 200,000 people, and owned by the federal government, that they need repair, but he refuses to do that. And then his budget, Brian, targets again those same states. Medicaid cut that could be $4 billion to New York, which would devastate this state, as well as cutting affordable housing, cutting community development, cutting the SNAP program, food assistance program. So he has, on the domestic side, specifically targeted and retaliated politically, I believe, against the Democratic states, which don't support him. And if his policies go through, or even a modification of his budget, it is going to compound an already difficult situation for this state. Our revenues are down $2.8 billion already this year. And I believe that's largely attributable to the tax reform that increases the taxes New Yorkers pay by, for the first time in history, requiring a tax on a tax. The federal government now taxes your city income, state income, and property tax. Never before in history, since 1861, has that happened.
Or they don't tax it exactly, but they don't let New Yorkers deduct those anymore beyond $10,000 in state and local taxes. And I guess the Republicans in Congress would ask, well, why should a high tax state like New York get subsidized, in effect, by the taxpayers of the rest of the country if we want to charge so much property tax, so much state income tax, et cetera?
First, to poke a little fun, you sound like a politician on your first answer. That's semantics. If they don't allow you to deduct, which they always have since 1861, when President Lincoln passed the first federal income tax to pay for the Civil War, which specifically said the federal tax shall be levied after state and local taxes. But if they don't allow you to deduct it, it means they are taxing it, which is what they're doing. Second, high tax state, because we're a high income state. And where is the fairness in saying to the state that contributes more to the federal government than it gets back and contributes more than any other state in the United States of America, we're now going to increase the taxation on our number one donor states? 50 states, 40 get more from the federal government than they pay. Only 10 states pay into the federal government more than they get back, and New York is number one of those 10 states. This from an administration, Brian, that is against redistribution of income. Mm. You shouldn't take from the rich and give to the poor, except when it comes to states. Then we should take from the richest to give to the poorest. It's a crock of baloney.
I see there was a protest yesterday in Albany by thousands of healthcare union members against your proposed cut of $500 million to Medicaid, New York State share of Medicaid for the next fiscal year. What are you proposing and why?
Well, my point is to bring attention to what the federal government is doing to this state. If we have a $4 billion cut to Medicaid, we can't absorb it. And on the initial proposed budget, it would be about a $500 million cut, which, frankly, we're looking at a far larger cut from the federal government if it's anywhere near $4 billion. So we have to find a way in this state to make that whole And in a budget where you're losing revenue to begin with, you're down $2.8 billion, you have a legislature that wants to spend a lot of good causes, and we have a new Senate that is eager to do a lot of good things. We have to remember, first and foremost, we have a real Medicaid problem, and that we have to take care of. Because Medicaid is the lifeblood of our healthcare system. It's not just poor people, which is the direct subsidy, but the Medicaid program subsidizes our whole healthcare system, which is vital to all New Yorkers and is also about 17% of this state's economy.
How does the $500 million in proposed cuts, and I hear what you're saying, if the federal government is going to cut $4 billion from New York State's Medicaid allocation, then and overall revenues are down for the state, then you have to save money where you spend money. But how does that not hurt patients? And is there anything in your plan to compensate with respect to the effect on patients?
I would not be satisfied with a budget that doesn't find a way to address the Medicaid funding shortfall. That has to be one of the top priorities. We want to do a lot of good things. We want to fund education at record levels. We want to fund affordable housing. But we must find a way to fund Medicaid and make up for the federal cut. That's the discussion we're in now.
I see the Senate and Assembly disagree on your permanent property tax cap of 2% increases per year. Is the tension here between the heavy burden of suburban property tax rates and the ability of local voters to decide to fund their schools in the way that they want to?
No, because, first of all, New York City doesn't have the property tax cap. It's only for localities out of the city. Outside of the city, and what it's been 2% for years, a locality can override it. It's not really a cap, Brian. It 3 out of 5 members of a local board can override it. But what it's saying is, at a time when your property taxes are going up as much as 30%, and I am afraid of a panic in many of the suburban areas where they pay the highest property tax in the United States. And if people start to sell homes and we see housing prices drop, we could have a problem. And those property taxes, because of the federal deduction or tax, depending on our semantic argument, they're going up 30%. My way of providing stability and confidence is saying, don't worry, the state tax will only go up 2%, and making that permanent is our best way of providing confidence and stability to homeowners across the state.
I see. And just to be clear for our listeners who may be in the city and don't understand this problem, and to reinforce the point you were making, just so people aren't confused about who's affected and who's not affected by this, schools are not funded by the property tax in New York City. That comes out of the general fund in the city. In the suburbs around New York and around the country, they're generally funded by property taxes. So the politics of property taxes and education become very different. In fact, we had a segment yesterday that I want to ask you about with Wall Street Journal education reporter Leslie Brody, who compared resources in the adjacent districts of Westbury and Jericho on Long Island. Jericho, according to her article, spends $37,000 a year per student. Westbury, a much more mixed income mixed race community, can afford just $24,000 with their lower property values. Leslie wrote about how Jericho students get robust college admissions counseling. In Jericho, each counselor has 300 kids. There's a vast difference in AP classes offered, field trips, and more. And the bottom line was, why is school funding in America, including New York, based so much on the, in effect, classist and racist formula of local property wealth, and how much will the state make up the difference? So what do you say to the students of Westbury and everybody else in that boat?
Amen. This is probably the most important topic I think in this state, if not in this country, Brian, we all talk about education, education, education. And the debate misses the fundamental point. And let me try again after all these years. Let's liken the education problem to the income problem in this country. It's not that we are a poor country. We're the richest country on the globe. The problem is the distribution of the income. It's the income inequality. On education in this state, it's not that we don't have money and we don't spend money. We spend more money than any state in the United States per pupil. Two times the national average. We are the education richest state in the nation. It is the distribution. And forget two districts on Long Island. In this state, we go from about $12,000 per pupil to about $34,000 per pupil. 12 to 34. How is that possible? Because the richer communities, as you pointed out accurately, have higher property taxes, higher wealth. They fund the schools through the property tax, and they pay more money. The poorer communities don't have that wealth. So you have a disparity of $12,000 to $34,000. You have a disparity within New York City, where the wealthier schools get more than the poorer schools. My whole point is we should do the opposite. Let's take the state funding and first prioritize funding to the poorer schools. Okay, Westbury's richer than a community in upstate New York, but let's take the state funding and basically make it an equalization fund to the best of our ability and say, I'm not giving any more money to the richer schools. I'm going to use the state funding to give to the poorer schools.
And yet I think in this budget cycle, there are a lot of poorer schools and poorer school districts who are arguing that the state isn't doing enough, and that's one of the tensions between your budget and the legislature's budget, right?
Well, because the legislature, let's leave the legislature out of this because I don't want to, I'm a week from having a budget or not. I don't want to annoy anyone more than I have to. The education movement says more money for all schools. I say that's a nice idea. It's also economically unrealistic when we have a shortfall, et cetera. It's economically unrealistic when we're spending more than any state in the United States. And that's not really the point. It's the distribution and the prioritization, and yes, more money for all schools is nice, and politically it's easy because you say yes to everyone, and politicians like to say yes to everyone. But the richer schools don't need more money from me. The poorer schools need more money. And whatever number we're going to spend, Brian, I'm going to be against giving the richer schools more because you're only furthering the disparity. If one school's at 12 and one school's at 34,000, why should I give the school at $34,000 any more money? Why wouldn't I bring up the school at 12,000? Politically, I understand why, because the person who represents the rich school wants to go home with more money. I get it. But what we should be doing as progressives is say, no, the richer school district doesn't need any more money from the state. Give it to the poorer schools and bring up the bottom. Bring up the bottom. Politically, they don't want to do that. Why? Because then the assemblyman, the senator who's from the richer district, goes home with nothing. And his or her residents say, why should I pay state taxes if I'm not getting anything back? Why should I pay my state taxes in Westbury or whatever the rich district was you mentioned?
Jericho.
Jericho. Why should I pay state taxes in Jericho if they're going to go to Utica, New York, or Buffalo, New York? So politically, they want to say, more money for everyone. From a progressive point of view, I want to say no, more money for the poorer schools.
Governor Cuomo, our guest here on WNYC, and as we move on down some of these budget items that are in play for the April 1st budget year and the deadline to pass the bills for the new budget year, how's congestion pricing going? Do you have the support to pass it?
Congestion pricing is the greatest opportunity we have had. We've talked about it for 20 years. It is the smartest idea, I think, for urban development. I used to be the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and congestion and traffic and mobility and regionalization has always been a topic, and we always had the ideal, but we've never been able to reach it. Mike Bloomberg got a lot of good work on trying to get congestion pricing. He failed. It is a tough issue, but I am cautiously optimistic. What it says is we have to fund the MTA. As anybody who uses the system knows, we've underfunded it for decades and decades. We need a steady revenue stream, so let's use tolls to do that. We need to discourage cars coming into Manhattan. Manhattan is the busiest traffic district in the United States. It's the third busiest traffic district on the globe.
And I'm going to jump in for time, and we know you're for it, and we've talked about this many times, what the arguments are for it. Mayor de Blasio, excuse me, is on board now. Do you have the votes?
That's a fairly blunt question. I have no votes at this moment because we haven't taken the vote, but I am cautiously optimistic that at the end of the day we get it done, and it would be a great, great victory. But it's the single toughest issue we have on the agenda.
Are you also for the pied-à-terre tax on very high-end second homes in New York City, which would also funnel money to the MTA?
That was my proposal, yes.
I guess you're for it.
I tend to be for my proposals,
yes.
By the way. Sometimes I disagree with myself, but I try to agree with my own proposals.
I think Ed Koch said, anybody who disagrees, who agrees with me 70% of the time is a genius. Anybody who agrees with me 100% of the time is nuts. I don't know if that applies when you're talking about yourself. On campaign finance reform, the Times has a story about how even with reforms that have taken place, lawmakers can and constantly do hold fundraising events in the Albany Room, a private venue virtually inside of the Capitol. How's campaign finance reform coming, and would you stamp that out?
I am, again, cautiously optimistic. I think it's one of the great opportunities. We have to do more. There's no doubt about it. We have to move towards a public financing model. It is, as your question suggests, controversial. We have done a lot of reforms in terms of campaign financing, but the best one is going to be a public financing system. And I hope that we have progress on that in the budget.
Criminal justice reform. I read that bail reform is a political sticking point. Who's influencing who, and what's your own position?
My own position is we've been trying to get bail reform done for 7 years. I proposed it every year for 7 years. We had a Republican Senate, and that was the apparent reason that we couldn't get it done. We now have a Democratic Senate, and there's no reason why we shouldn't get it done. It is inherently discriminatory. Lady Justice wears a blindfold and is not supposed to be judging wealth. When you have a cash bail system, what you're really saying is if you can make bail, you walk, and if you can't make bail, you go to a place called Rikers Island, the worst jail in this state, one of the worst jails in the United States, and you sit there for 2 or 3 years until you have your day in court, and you hope that you don't get abused while you're there. That we allow Rikers to continue to operate is a tragedy. In the most progressive city, in the most progressive state, 10-year plan to close Rikers. If you had come up with a 10-year plan to close anything else that involved the rich and the powerful and the wealthy, they would have stormed your station and every other station. But 10 years, why? Because they're poor people and they're powerless people. We have to reform the cash bail system so you make a decision on the merits and not who can afford to make bail or not. Money was not supposed to have anything to do with it. You weren't supposed to be judging wealth. You were supposed to be judging a risk of flight.
So who's against this in Albany that makes, with that argument, which sounds like common sense to a lot of our listeners in New York City and downstate in general, who's against this that it's not sailing through?
The law enforcement community raises the question, if you don't use cash bail, what is the decision-making process for a judge to use to release an individual? And it's less an issue, Brian, of, okay, we won't use cash, but cash was a proxy for risk of flight. And what is the new standard that would be used? And that is a valid question, and that's what we're debating.
In New York City, the education headline this week has been the admissions to the so-called specialized high schools, Bronx Science, Stuyvesant, Brooklyn Tech, and the four others, were as racially disparate as ever. And Mayor de Blasio wants to abolish the admissions single test system. It's just one test and you get in or not, and go to, I guess, something more complicated like the Ivy League universities use, where they're certainly looking at SAT scores, but they're looking at students holistically for who could benefit the most from that kind of elite education. But the legislature has to approve that. One, should the legislature, should the state be able to rule over New York City and what it does with admissions policies for high schools just within the city at all? And what's your position on whether the single test admission policy should be abolished?
On the powers of the state, we have a constitution that says federal power, state power, city powers, and we are one state. The specialized schools pose a really obvious and obnoxious problem. The recent numbers only reinforce it. There are eight specialized schools. Five of the eight, the city can control the admission testing. I would suggest the city council comes up with their admission policy for those five, and the state legislature, which says they want to do hearings on an admission policy, should then be informed by that admission policy for the remaining three. But five of the schools, the admission policy can be set by the city. And I think they should set it, your point about city autonomy, city opinion, home rule. Let them set the policy for the five and then say to the legislature, I know you're doing hearings. I know you're going to pass the state law, hopefully. Here's the city's opinion on what the admission policy should be.
Last thing, I know you had a very strong reaction to President Trump's reaction to the massacre in New Zealand the other day, I guess when he refused the request of the Prime Minister of New Zealand to say he stands with the Muslims of the world. What was it that you were reacting strongly to with respect to Trump and New Zealand?
Look, I have a strong reaction to almost everything the President does. And by the way, he has a strong reaction to me, just to be fair. He says tweets about me, unkind, untrue things, but that's nothing new. This is a president who continually reinforces a spirit of division and meanness that is a spreading cancer in this country. And we are made up of diversity, and maybe we're more sensitive to it as New Yorkers, and maybe New Yorker is the monument to diversity and e pluribus unum and forming community from a diverse population. But he started with the Muslim ban as soon as he put his foot in the White House. And he's always targeted the different people and tried to demonize differences, religious differences, ethnic differences, sexual differences. And it is ripping this country apart. And that's what he affirmed with his comments about New Zealand. And we see people acting out on the hatred he's spreading all across this country. And I think it is probably one of the most dangerous times we've had, because the enemy is now within, Brian. The enemy is demonizing differences rather than celebrating them, highlighting differences rather than finding commonality. And that is repugnant to me for a government leader, especially President of the United States.
New York State has a policy of, if I'm not mistaken, no state business with companies that boycott Israel. And there's another side that says that's biased and that's a violation of free speech. You, as the state, shouldn't be banning contracts with companies because of their First Amendment and private sector right to choose who to do business with, especially if the issue for them is that they feel a foreign government, Israel in this case, is violating human rights. Why would that argument be wrong?
Look, we have relationships that are important to us, and as New Yorkers, our relationship with Israel and the Jewish community is important to us. We stand against anti-Semitism. We stand against the violence that Israel has seen. We believe in human rights for everyone, and we're proud of that fact. But yes, we stand against anti-Semitism, and yes, we stand with Israel. And the Jewish community is a vital part of New York, and New York would not be what New York is without the Jewish community. And we're proud of that relationship. It's not a political one. It's a personal one. If you grew up, you know, I'm a native New Yorker. Two of my sisters married gentlemen who are Jewish. Why? Because we are one New York. We're one family. We're one community.
But what about Muslims in this community who might be business owners, or non-Muslims who are business owners who feel that Israeli government policy, not Jews as Jews, are oppressing the people in the occupied territories and want to express that with their business decisions?
Yeah, we respect, as we just experienced with New Zealand, we were the first state to stand up and speak up for the protection of our Muslim brothers and sisters.
But the state says if that's your position, we won't do business with your company, right?
Well, we're not going to participate in discriminating against Israel. Yes.
Governor Cuomo, we always appreciate it. Talk to you next time.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.